Thank you for having me, and I have to report back to Chicago when I return that there is life in Vancouver. We thought it was a wilderness here. Actually, I thought it was very near Chicago. I figured I'm in Chicago, which is middle of the United States and towards the north, so I figured it was a half-hour trip. And I was kind of shocked. I left work at 5 p.m. for the airport, and I got here Chicago time, 2:30 a.m., which means I could have gotten to Peking, I think, in that time. It was, I guess Canada's a big country. I don't know. Americans are not too strong on geography. Or anything else, for that matter. Well, the title of the talk is a slight modification of what I think you intended to hear, but if you bear me out for a short period of time, I'll most certainly get to the subject which seems to have lured you into coming here this evening, namely the topic of anti-Semitism and how does it bear on criticism of Israel. But before getting there, I want to discuss the topic which I handed to the person who introduced me this evening, namely the subject of real and fabricated disagreements over the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I'm going to begin, if you forgive me, with a kind of personal note, because May 2004 marks a small anniversary for me. Exactly 20 years ago this month, perhaps just a couple of weeks difference, a book came out by an author or alleged author named Joan Peters, and the book was entitled From Time Immemorial. When the book and I had walked into a bookstore, it was just at that point at the end of my research phase for my doctoral dissertation and was going to commence the phase of organizing the material and then writing. And I walked into a bookstore and I see this book. It was then Harper and Row Books, now they're Harper Collins. I see this book, it's entitled From Time Immemorial, and the book promises, according to the front cover, to revolutionize our understanding of the Israel-Palestine conflict. I then, as most academics do, a topic to which I'll return later, I flipped to the back of the book to see who had written blurbs for the book. And in fact, the blurbs were quite impressive. You had people like Nobel laureates Saul Bellow, Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel, historian Barbara Tuchman, another Holocaust historian named Lucy Dawidowicz, a quite impressive roster of endorsements for the book, all promising in one form or another that it's going to revolutionize our understanding of the Middle East. Well, that of course filled me with a little bit of trepidation because I thought I had a fairly good handle on the topic and I was preparing to write my dissertation. And of course, I was fearful that everything that I thought I knew would now prove to be wrong. And the Peters thesis was really quite audacious. Her basic thesis was that contrary to all conventional opinion, Palestine had been empty on the eve of the Zionist colonization. The settlers came to Palestine, made the desert bloom, and then all the Arabs from neighboring countries surreptitiously, they sneaked into Palestine, and then they pretended to be indigenous to the area. That, in fact, all of these Palestinian refugees were really simply immigrants from neighboring countries who wanted to exploit the opportunities created by the Zionist settlers, and that this whole notion of a Palestinian people was not just metaphorically, but it was literally a fraud. I noticed the person in the front seat here laughed when she heard that, and had it been another time in another place, I would have laughed as well. But this was a different point in my life. It was 1984, and when I was a young person, I had very strong political beliefs, and I also, those beliefs I thought were solidly grounded in scholarship, solidly grounded in facts and history. I read a lot, read a lot of literature conforming to my political beliefs, and even read literature which opposed my political beliefs, Nonetheless, I was quite confident that what I believed was right. By the late 1970s, events unfolded in parts of the world which proved to be a really crushing awakening for me. Many things which I was absolutely certain were true proved not to be true. And scholars who I had a very high regard for and who had excellent academic credentials from the best universities and the best formal training and scholarship, they turned out to be wrong. As I said, it was a totally crushing experience for me. My world literally caved in, and there were quite a number of weeks where my recollection is, and it's kind of vague now, but I just was in bed totally devastated. I was lucky it came at a relatively young age. Other people had those political awakenings at a later age and were never able to bounce back. I was able to bounce back, but I learned a very good lesson then. And the lesson is that you better listen to all sides, and you better be very careful about what you say and what you think. And don't dismiss anything as being absurd or ridiculous. Be patient, go through the evidence. So when the Joan Peters book came out, even though on the face of it, the thesis seemed absolutely absurd, how could 4.5 million people now have fabricated their genealogies? That just seemed on the face of it absurd. On the other hand, unlike other people, I was simply not willing to dismiss it out of hand because it didn't conform to my beliefs. Based on past experience, my beliefs could be wrong. And so I took the book, and I have to admit with a certain amount of defensiveness, but I picked up that book and I started to go through it footnote by footnote. Peters used to boast that the book had 1,853 footnotes, and it was a very formidable scholarly apparatus. That's the fancy word for all the footnotes at the end. And I sat down and I went at that book methodically. And the book was very densely written. The prose was almost impenetrable, purposely, I think. But I wouldn't give up. If I was wrong, I wanted to know I was wrong. And I wanted to know it then and not later. Because I had been, as I said, seduced by causes which proved to be, for me at least, a moral and an intellectual embarrassment. And there was a core of the book which was a demographic study of population movements in Palestine. The book had a large number of chapters devoted to this study, and it also had a large number of charts at the back. The demographic study was endorsed by one of the leading population experts in the United States, a fellow named Philip Hauser, who was the chair of the Department of Demography. It wasn't called demography, population studies at the University of Chicago. It was a very prestigious position. And he even had a letter appended at the end of the book affirming Peters's findings. And that was very intimidating to me. I obviously didn't then and don't know now anything about demography. And here was a leading authority in the topic. Well, notwithstanding that intimidating authority figure hanging before me, I sat down and I started to go through those charts with a vengeance. I don't believe in computers, well, I do believe in computers, I still don't use calculators. I had a piece of paper, I had my pencil, and I'm sitting and lying down that bed, I'm gonna figure this out if it kills me. Because if it's right, I'm wrong. And if I'm wrong, I wanna know it now. So I go through these charts, checking the numbers, flipping the book back and forth, finally around 1 a.m., 1:30 a.m., one evening, early one morning, I discover that the key number in the charts is a fraud. The key number is a fake, and there was no question whatsoever that that number was not accidentally faked. The way the material was arranged, it was clearly premeditated. Well, I was, I was a relatively young man then. I was just gripped with, feeling, the chills going down your spine. I can't believe it. And I had a small studio apartment, and I was pacing back and forth. I did it. I can't believe it. I did it. I was almost breathless. And I did what any good Jewish boy does at that moment. It was 1:30 a.m., but I called my mother. And my mother got on the phone, and I said, "Mom, I did it, I did it, I did it." And my mother said, "You know, Norman, I'm very happy for you," like a good Jewish mother. And then she paused, and she said, "Well, what did you do?" And, it was impossible at 1:30 in the morning to explain this demographic chart. I said, I discovered a fraud, a hoax, no question about it. I had very little doubt. I can't say no question about it. De omnibus dubi tandem, that's, Marx, always doubt. But I was pretty confident. I remember later, I have a very good friend who recently passed away, the Marxist economist, some of you may know, Paul Sweezy, and he once commented to me afterwards, he said that discovering a fraud is every scholar's eureka. And it was my eureka, then proved that my findings were right, and that was one stage, and then the next stage was I sent out a copy of my findings to everybody who I thought, not everybody, but let's say 20, it was about 25 people who I thought would be interested in the topic or interested in my discovery, as it were. 24 of the 25 didn't respond at all. The 25th did respond. One Saturday morning, I remember quite vividly, I got a phone call, and the person on the other side identified himself as, "This is Professor Chomsky calling." Not every day Professor Chomsky calls a young man living in Washington Heights on a barely surviving salary. And he said that he'd read my findings, he found them convincing, and that was probably just the tip of the iceberg, that if I go through the book more carefully, you'll probably discover that the whole thing is a fraud. I'm a person of the left, and when you get a call from Professor Chomsky, his wish is your command. So I, for the next several months, devoted myself to going through the whole scholarly apparatus, checking everything against the original sources, and it turned out that what he said was correct. The whole book was a fraud from start to finish. All the documents were mangled, falsified. It was quite a spectacular hoax. And that's when I sort of became involved in a large way in the Israel-Palestine conflict. I first became involved politically during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in June 1982, and it was at that point I decided to write my doctoral dissertation in Zionism. By 1984, you could say, as it were, I gave over my life to the movement, and that's what I've been doing for the last 20 years. And now, when you look back, it's an anniversary of sorts, and anniversaries are always moments for reflection. And, I had to, in the past few months, reflect not only on the passage of time, painful as that is, but also on what was accomplished and what did I learn over these past 20 years. And the main thing I learned, it's a kind of underwhelming self-revelation, underwhelming epiphany. The main thing I learned is that, in fact, the Israel-Palestine conflict is really not complicated at all. It doesn't raise any terrifically complicated moral questions. There are some to which I'll return. And on the historical questions, it doesn't raise anything really significantly difficult to apprehend. It's not a complicated conflict, in my view. And in fact, at least at two levels, there's practically no controversy that remains at all. I don't say at all, but practically no controversy that remains. On the historical record, namely the record of what happened over the past 100 years, there's relatively little controversy now. There was a period when there was a lot of controversy. There are enough people in the audience who are roughly of my generation to recall that even as late as the 1970s, early 1980s, there was a kind of dominant, I hate academic terms, so I should be shot if I use any of them, but I'll use one, and I'll limit myself to that. There was a kind of dominant narrative of what happened in the Israel-Palestine conflict. And it was more or less the official Israeli view. For any of you of the older generation who read Leon Uris's Exodus, you can call it pretty much the Exodus version of history, and that was the dominant one. And then alongside the dominant one, there was on the margins or on the fringes, there were some dissenting voices claiming that the interpretation that we were familiar with, the one we had read and heard over and over again, that that interpretation was in fundamental ways untrue. So you take the case of the Palestinian refugees. The dominant interpretation, the one which everybody heard and or had known by memory, I'm sure by the up until the mid-1980s, was that the Arab armies invade Palestine in 1948. There were these Arab radio broadcasts telling the Palestinians to flee. The Palestinians followed the orders from the radio, left, and it was supposed to be the Arab armies were going to sweep the Jews into the sea and then the Palestinians would return, but that's not what happened, and so the Palestinians got what they deserved. Well, already in the early 1960s, there were two scholars, one named Erskine Childers, an Irishman, and a Palestinian named Vali Khalidi, and they went back and they checked this original interpretation, because as it happened, or I should say, this official interpretation, because as it happened, that area in 1948 was very heavily monitored by intelligence organizations, and they all kept tapes of the radio broadcasts. So Mr. Childers and Mr. Khalidi, they go and they check the various tapes of the radio broadcasts, go through all of them. They find no evidence of Arab radio broadcasts. It didn't happen. They published their findings in a British periodical called The Spectator, but it had relatively little impact. The dominant narrative remained, though people knew on the fringes there were some dissenting voices. Well, things have dramatically changed now.